THE LOG by Guy de Maupassant. The drawing room was small, full of heavy draperies and discreetly fragrant. A large fire burned in the grate, and a solitary lamp at one end of the mantelpiece threw a soft light on the two persons who were talking. She, the mistress of the house, was an old lady with white hair, one of those old ladies whose unwrinkled skin is as smooth as the finest paper, and scented, impregnated with perfume, with the delicate essences which she had used in her bath for so many years. He was an old friend, who had never married, a constant friend, a companion in the journey of life, but nothing more. They had not spoken for about a minute, and were both looking at the fire, dreaming of no matter what. In one of those moments of friendly silence between people who have no need to be constantly talking in order to be happy together, when suddenly a large log, a stump covered with burning roots, fell out. It fell over the fire dogs and into the drawing room, rolled onto the carpet, scattering great sparks around it. The old lady, with a little scream, sprang to her feet to run away, while he kicked the log back on the hearth and stamped out all the burning sparks with his boots. When the disaster was remedied, there was a strong smell of burning, and, sitting down opposite his friend, the man looked at her with a smile and said, as he pointed to the log, "That is the reason why I never married." She looked at him in astonishment, with the inquisitive gaze of a woman who wished to know everything, that eye which women have who are no longer very young, in which a complex and often roguish curiosity is reflected, and she asked, "How so?" "Oh, it is a long story," he replied, "and rather unpleasant. My old friends were often surprised at the coldness which suddenly sprang between one of my best friends, whose Christian name was Julien, and myself. They could not understand how two such intimate and inseparable friends as we had been could suddenly become almost strangers to one another, and I will tell you the reason for it. He and I used to live together at one time. We were never apart, and the friendship that united us seemed so strong that nothing could break it. One evening, when he came home, he told me that he was going to get married, and it gave me a shock as if he had robbed me or betrayed me. When a man's friend marries, it is all over between them. The jealous affection of a woman, that suspicious, uneasy, carnal affection, will not tolerate the sturdy and frank attachment, that attachment of the mind, of the heart, and that mutual confidence that exists between two men. You see, however great the love may be that unites them, a man and a woman are always strangers in mind and intellect. They remain belligerents. They belong to different races. They must always be conqueror and conquered, a master and a slave, now the one, now the other. They are never two equals. They press each other's hands, those hands trembling with amorous passion, but they never press them with a long, strong, loyal pressure, with that pressure which seems to open hearts and to lay them bare in a burst of sincere, strong, manly affection. Philosophers of old, instead of marrying and procreating children as consolation for their old age, children who would abandon them, sought for a good, reliable friend, and grew old with him in that communion of thought which can only exist between men. Well, my friend Julian married. His wife was pretty, charming, a little curly-haired blonde, plump and lively, who seemed to worship him. At first I went but rarely to their house, feeling myself superfluous. But somehow they attracted me to their home. They were constantly inviting me, and seemed very fond of me. Consequently, by degrees, I allowed myself to be allured by the charm of their life. I often dined with them, and frequently, when I returned home at night, thought that I would do so as he had done, and get married, as my empty house now seemed very dull. They appeared to be very much in love, and were never apart. Well, one evening Julian wrote and asked me to come to dinner, and I naturally went. "My dear fellow," he said, "I must go out directly after business, and I shall not be back until 11 o'clock, but I shall be back at 11 precisely, and I reckon on you to keep Bertha company." The young woman smiled. "It was my idea," she said, "to send for you." I held out my hand to her. "You are as nice as ever," I said, and I felt a long, friendly pressure of my fingers. I paid no attention to it. So we sat down to dinner, and at 8 o'clock Julian went out. As soon as he had gone, a kind of strange embarrassment immediately seemed to arise between his wife and me. We had never been alone together. and in spite of our daily increasing intimacy, this tête-à-tête placed us in a new position. At first I spoke vaguely of those indifferent matters with which one fills up an embarrassing silence, but she did not reply, and remained opposite me with her head down in an undecided manner, as if she were thinking over some difficult subject, and I was at a loss for small talk. I held my tongue. It is surprising how hard it is at times to find anything to say. And then also I felt something in the air, something I could not express, one of those mysterious premonitions that warn one of another person's secret intentions in regard to yourself, whether they be good or evil. That painful silence lasted some time, and then Bertha said to me, "Would you be kind enough to put a log on the fire, for it is going out?" So I opened up the box where the wood was kept, which was placed just where yours is, took out the largest log, and put it on top of the others, which were three-quarters burned, and then silence again reigned in the room. In a few minutes the log was burning so brightly that it scorched our faces, and the young woman raised her eyes to mine, eyes that had a strange look to me. "It is too hot now," she said. "Let us go and sit on the sofa over there." So we went and sat on the sofa, and then she said suddenly, looking at me full in the face, "What would you do if a woman were to tell you that she were in love with you?" "Upon my word," I replied, very much at a loss for an answer, "I cannot foresee such a case, but it would depend very much upon the woman." She gave a hard, nervous, vibrating laugh, one of those false laughs which seems as if they must break thin glass, and then she added, "Men are never either venturesome or spiteful," and after a moment of silence, she continued, "Have you ever been in love, Monsieur Poirot?" I was obliged to acknowledge that I certainly had, and she asked me to tell her about it, whereupon I made up some story or other. She listened to me attentively, with frequent signs of disapproval and contempt, and then suddenly she said, "No, you understand nothing about the subject. It seems to me that real love must unsettle the mind, upset the nerves, distract the head, that it must, how shall I express it, be dangerous, even terrible, almost criminal and sacrilegious, that it must be a kind of treason. I mean to say that it is bound to break laws, fraternal bonds, sacred obligations. When love is tranquil, easy, lawful, without dangers, is it really love?" I did not know how to give answer to her, and I made this philosophical reflection to myself, "O female brain, here indeed you show yourself." While speaking, she had assumed a demure, saintly air, and, resting on the cushions, she stretched herself out at full length, with her head on my shoulder, and her dress pulled up a little so as to show her red stockings, which the firelight made look still brighter. In a minute or two she continued, "I suppose I have frightened you." I protested against such a notion, and she leaned against my breast altogether, and without looking at me, she said, "If I were to tell you that I love you, what would you do?" And, before I could think of an answer, she had thrown her arms around my neck, had quickly drawn her head down, and put her lips to mine. "Oh, my dear friend, how can I tell you that I did not feel at all happy? What? Deceive Julian? Become the lover of this little, silly, wrong-headed, deceitful woman who was, no doubt, terribly sensual, and whom her husband no longer satisfied? To betray him continually, to deceive him, to play at being in love merely because I was attracted by forbidden fruit, by the danger incurred and the friendship betrayed? No, that did not suit me. But what was I to do? To imitate Joseph would be acting a very stupid and moreover difficult part, for this woman was enchanting in her perfidy, inflamed by audacity, palpitating and excited. Let the man who has never felt on his lips the warm kiss of a woman who is ready to give herself to him throw the first stone at me. Well, a minute more, you understand what I mean? A minute more, and I should have been, no, she should have been, I beg your pardon, he would have been, when a loud noise made us both jump up. The log had fallen into the room, knocking over the fire irons and the fender, and onto the carpet, which it had scorched, and had rolled under the armchair, which it would certainly set alight. I jumped up like a madman, and, as I was replacing on the fire that log which saved me, the door opened hastily, and Julian came in. "I am free," he said with evident pleasure. "The business was over 2 hours sooner than I expected." "Yes, my dear friend, without that log I should have been caught in the very act, and you know what the consequences of that would have been. You may be sure that I took great care never to be found in a similar situation again. Never, never." Soon after, I saw that Julian was giving me the cold shoulder, as they say. His wife was evidently undermining our friendship. By degrees, he got rid of me, and we have altogether ceased to meet. I never married, which ought not surprise you, I think. The End of the Log by Guy de Maupassant, read by Roy Schreiber.